A worthless sapphire became the most talked about gem in America. How? Jerry Weintraub's father, Samuel, a jewelry salesman from the Bronx, gave it an exotic name, the Star of Artaban, displayed it behind armed guards, generated press coverage, and eventually donated it to the Smithsonian. The publicity helped him sell his entire jewelry collection to merchants nationwide. Young Jerry watched this masterclass in creating value from nothing, learning that perception shapes reality and that every product needs a story. This wasn't deception, it was showmanship. When his father refused to buy him a coveted red James Dean jacket, insisting he earn it himself, 14-year-old Jerry launched a delivery business, managing a team handling everything from dry cleaning to groceries. Later, stationed in Alaska during his Air Force service, he recognized opportunity in the isolation of soldiers near the Soviet border. Working at Saks Men's Shop, he created a beach-themed window display selling vacation packages to cold, lonely servicemen, plane tickets, hotels, beach gear, everything but the girl. This ability to sell dreams, not just products, would define his entire career. Before Weintraub, regional promoters controlled concert territories while artists earned less. Weintraub demolished this system with Elvis Presley's comeback tour, using Elvis's star power to bypass middlemen and book directly with arenas. Instead of commission, he structured a three-way profit split between Elvis, Colonel Parker, and himself, creating economies of scale that increased everyone's earnings while making him the most hated man in the industry. Bill Graham told Newsweek, "Jerry Weintraub comes into town like an eagle, scoops up the money, and leaves." Weintraub's response? "Of course that's what I do. It's called business." His key relationships shifted to arena owners, wheelers and dealers, political players, sharpies and sharks interested in bricks and mortar, not art. One such figure was Arthur Wirtz, the 6'6" giant who owned Chicago Stadium and most NHL franchises. After waiting 4 hours while Wirtz sat signing checks, Weintraub exploded when dismissed with, "Screw you." Wirtz laughed, shook his hand, and they began a decades-long friendship that generated millions through exclusive deals in hockey buildings nationwide. Weintraub freely admitted he was no actor and couldn't type well enough to be a secretary. His empire was built on relationships and unwavering commitment to his word. When Frank Sinatra asked him to manage his comeback tour, Weintraub expressed concern about Sinatra's reputation for missed performances. Sinatra's eyes turned icy, then he pointed at Weintraub. "Here's what we're going to do. You and I are going to shake hands and promise. I'm never going to disappoint you, and you're never going to disappoint me, are you?" They shook on it, and neither ever broke that promise. When Colonel Tom Parker surprised him by sharing merchandise profits after their first Elvis tour, he explained simply, "When I have a partner, I have a partner." Weintraub adopted this philosophy throughout his career. His marriage to singer Jane Morgan opened doors to an elite network that included George H.W. Bush, who brought him to state dinners with world leaders. From mafia bosses who declared him their nephew to the Lubavitcher Rebbe whose guidance he sought, Weintraub's genuine interest in people transcended all boundaries. When Weintraub discovered John Denver playing empty Greenwich Village clubs for $70 a show, he became his test case for packaging an artist from scratch. Weintraub created buzz by talking him up relentlessly, embellishing stories, like claiming Bob Dylan attended nightly. Within weeks, the venue was packed. Denver had already recorded Take Me Home Country Roads for RCA, but Weintraub needed people to hear it. He sent Denver on radio tours alone with his guitar, his wholesome image perfectly timed for early 70s America craving trustworthy figures. Rather than presenting Denver as new, Weintraub sold him as already established, someone audiences had loved for years. He plastered Denver's face on billboards from Bel Air to Hollywood, creating instant familiarity. Weintraub even convinced RCA to release a greatest hits album when Denver had only one hit, securing a $1 million deal. The album topped the charts. Yet success brought challenges. Denver struggled with his identity and craved critical acclaim. When he eventually fired Weintraub, his career declined sharply. RCA and his agency dropped him, and he never regained his former prominence. By the late 1970s, Weintraub stared at his daily call list and realized he didn't want to return any calls. The issue wasn't making calls, but having to make them. He quit management entirely, transitioning to film production. His first major film, Oh God, starring George Burns, met skepticism from Warner Bros. Executives who dismissed it as a nice little picture. Weintraub demanded $5 million for TV marketing, unprecedented at the time. Though initially rejected, he convinced executives to risk their careers supporting him. The gamble paid off with packed theaters and box office success. Other significant productions included Diner, launching careers for Ellen Barkin, Mickey Rourke, and Kevin Bacon, and The Karate Kid, inspired by a news story about a bullied kid who learned karate. Finding Pat Morita for Mr. Miyagi proved challenging, until director John Avildsen showed Weintraub a test video that moved him to tears. Morita earned an Academy Award nomination. The Oceans trilogy, grossing over $1 billion worldwide, became his career capstone. Weintraub's journey revealed timeless principles. Tell the truth. When Lou Wasserman caught him making a 3-hour personal call, his honesty earned him a mentor. Listen when others speak. His greatest skill was hearing what people truly wanted. Sell with joy. His genuine excitement was contagious. Never fear failure. He attempted organizing an Elvis versus Ricky Nelson softball game without knowing either star, and played himself in The Firm despite limited acting ability. Know which calls to return. Unlike his friend Irving Azov, who returned every client call, Weintraub chose strategically, focusing on projects that brought joy. After Weintraub Entertainment Group's failure cost him $30 million, his friend Steve Ross told him, "Companies always go away. It's talent that counts." He returned to producing, having learned that if you find something you love, keep doing it. As Weintraub aged and friends died, his view of mortality shifted. "When your parents die, the wall between you and death collapses," he observed. He feared death intensely until visiting dying friend Guy McWane, who smiled and said, "It's just another journey." This transformed his perspective completely. What ultimately defined his life wasn't wealth or achievements, but extraordinary relationships, from presidents to mobsters, Elvis to Clooney, the Lubavitcher Rebbe to Armand Hammer. These connections shaped the latter 20th century. Even his family life reflected this capacity for complex bonds. When he fell in love with Susie Eckens in the 1990s, his wife, Jane, responded with wisdom, maintaining their loving family connection without divorce while living separately. Looking back from the Bronx to Hollywood, Weintraub saw key moments, refusing the jewelry business, declining dance tights, ignoring call sheets that created his remarkable trajectory. Whatever lay ahead, he was determined to rush to meet it with joy. This is, after all, a Jerry Weintraub production.